And on the phone with us now from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, Evelyn Lees. Good morning.
Good morning. Sorry to disappoint you, though. It's Greg Gagne this morning. Yeah, Ev and I swapped shifts, but I'll do the best I can. Warm before the storm. Mountain temperatures were in the 30s now, and winds are out of the southwest, and they are increasing. For recent activity, so over this past Saturday and Sunday, there were reports of small avalanches, that 3 to 5 inches of storm snow, and it was failing on a layer of weak, faceted snow. This formed during that long period of high pressure from Christmas through this past Friday. Couple of exceptions, though. One of them was a larger, these were on the Salt Lake Mountains. One was a larger slide, a little over 10,000 feet on an east aspect in upper Little Cottonwood. It was up to 2 feet deep. And then the one that really caught my attention, again, on the Mill Creek Canyon in the Salt Lake Mountains, 2 feet deep, 150 feet wide, and ran 600 feet vertical. Large avalanche. And this avalanche ran on a weak layer that formed back in November. I'm suspecting by about midweek, we're going to be hearing about more avalanching on these deeper layers. So for today, two primary avalanche problems. One, wind slab. So increasing winds today, as well as the winds that blew over this past weekend, they're creating these sensitive pockets of fresh wind drifts. These are on a variety of aspects at the upper elevations, and the increasing winds today are really going to elevate this hazard. I'm not expecting these drifts to be too large, but they're sensitive because they're sitting on top of weak, faceted snow. Secondly, persistent slab. Boy, we were saying this all season long. The snowpack at the mid and upper elevations facing northwest through east, they're plagued with weaknesses from the ground all the way to the old snow surface sitting just below the Saturday storm. The Saturday storm wasn't enough to affect these deeper layers, and most of the activity over this past weekend has been in this layer just sitting around 3 to 6 inches down from the snow surface. But the two avalanches that we got just mentioned in Little Cottonwood as well as in Mill Creek Canyon indicate that they can break down more deeply. So for the bottom line, we're going with an overall avalanche hazard of moderate, where there's pockets of fresh wind drifts. I'm going to find these primarily at the upper elevations, although with increasing winds today, they may work their way down into lower or mid elevations. There's also a moderate hazard of persistent slab avalanches on slopes facing north through east. There may be a little bit of minor wet-loose activity at lower elevations. Lower-angled slopes that aren't wind-loaded, hazard is low. And one thing I really want to emphasize, Leslie, is we're expecting a rising avalanche hazard this week. You just heard the weather forecast. We're expecting snow and significant water amounts. So please, all you listeners, pay attention to the avalanche hazard this week. We're expecting it to rise with potentially dangerous conditions by midweek.
Okay, Greg. Hey, thank you. Well, the Stuyterville Basin Planning Commission meets tomorrow in regular session starting at 4:30 at the Richens Building Auditorium. On the phone with me to preview that agenda, I have planner Ray Milliner and Jennifer Strader. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Ray,
good morning, Leslie.
Hi. So, Ray, let's start with you. The agenda starts with a public hearing and possible approval for the Woodward-Gargosa facility, which includes a main building of more than 52,000 square feet and in one portion of the building more than 45 feet high. Height exception has already been granted by the Summit County Council. It's expected to bring out the neighbors opposed to the project. Maybe just a bit of background here. As I recall, this area was approved as a ski area and recreation area long before any of the development showed up along Kilby Road and Pine Brook, yeah?
Yeah, that was approved as the Gargosa Park specially planned area back in 1999. It approved a number of outdoor recreation activities, skiing, tubing, mountain biking, those kind of things. The Planning Commission went through an extensive review just to figure out the use on the property, and they ended up determining that this building would be considered accessory to those uses because it's a training facility for those type of recreation uses, and the accessory building is a conditional use that's greater than 10,000 square feet.
So any idea where the Planning Commission is going to come down on this? I mean, last we had heard that most of the Planning Commission seemed to support the project, except that Commissioner Chuck Klingenstein was hoping that the mass could be broken up. BPEC still liked the location up the hillside.
Yeah, exactly right.
Hey, Ray, you still there? Can't you're breaking up.
Can you hear me?
Now we can, yes.
Okay, sorry. So at the last few meetings, we've had approximately 8 work sessions on this project, and it seems that most of the issues that have come up have been addressed by the applicant. We've got lighting, we've got noise, we've got the size and massing of the building. They've done and a number of things to try to mitigate all of the issues associated with the project. Whether or not the Planning Commission is ready to vote on it.
You're still breaking up pretty badly. Are you driving, or can you pull over? Or Ray, are you there? Well, Jennifer, let's move to you. The Rasmussen Place project from former Salt Lake County Mayor Peter Caroon. It's a mixed-use project with 108 residential units, 65 market rate, and 43 affordable. Does this project pass a compelling countervailing need as specified in the general plan to allow you to create this new entitlement?
Well, the Planning Commission has reviewed this twice in a work session, and then they've held a public hearing. And I think that they have given some positive feedback. And so we decided that it's probably time to move forward with an additional public hearing and a recommendation. They have consistently said that they've felt like with the number of units, the applicant is proposing approximately 40% of the units is affordable, that they felt that that would satisfy a compelling countervailing public interest.
So tell me what this waterfall provision is.
So basically what that means is that the units would first be prioritized for Summit County residents. And typically you'd have a time frame associated with that. So you'd say, you know, you'd have the Summit County residents first on the list, and then if after, say, 6 months or a year, you're not filling the units, then you can move down to different, you know, maybe workers of Summit County, and then you can open it up to anybody so that you don't create a project where, you know, you've got an affordable housing project, but it's filled with people that are living in Salt Lake and working in Salt Lake.
Right. So how is that enforced?
Well, it would have to be enforced through the restrictions, the deed restrictions, as well as an agreement that would be made. Typically, you have an agreement that would be made with, like, Mountainlands Community Housing Trust. And so I know other developments have done it. The new Canyon Corners development has a waterfall provision in their code. So typically through those deed restrictions is how you would enforce it.
Yeah. So are we going to implement that then for this project?
Right now, we're not sure. The applicant would like to continue to research that as a possibility. It will depend on whether or not tax credits are utilized for the project. According to the applicant, if tax credits are utilized, that may not be a possibility, but that hasn't yet been decided.
The project also calls for some 8,200 square feet of commercial. What kind of commercial are we talking about here?
So these are going to be mostly neighborhood commercial type uses that should serve the existing residents, the residents of that development. So you're looking at things like it could be bakeries and coffee shops and laundromats, things like that. The Planning Commission did want to restrict some of the uses so that you didn't end up with something like a gas station there that would generate people from the surrounding area coming into the neighborhood. But more neighborhood commercial type uses is what the applicant is proposing.
Okay. Can you locate the property there on Rasmussen?
Yeah. So it's located just directly to the west of the existing Park City RV resort. So it's between the RV resort and the existing storage unit.
Okay. So closer to Kimball Junction than the Jeremy Ranch interchange.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
My understanding is that the project also leaves some space there in case UDOT would want to create an interchange on the land sometime in the future. Is that's a requirement then?
Well, it's not necessarily a requirement, but the applicant has been willing to leave that space open. The first proposals that we saw did include some small cabins located on that west end of the property. In UDOT's long-range plan, they do have a proposed interchange there that could include some roundabouts that would affect the applicant's property. And so it's also that interchange and associated roundabouts are also within the Snyderville Basin transportation plan. And so we have worked with the applicant, you know, just on leaving that property as is for now.
Finally, a work session on the Bittner Station proposal. This is a mixed-use project. Where is this located from the fire station?
So it's located just to the east of the fire station. There's a small office building that's directly adjacent to the fire station, and it's just east of that. It's a four-acre parcel.
Okay.
Just before you get to the roundabout.
Okay. We're talking about some 79 multifamily residential units, including 32 affordable and some 5,000 square feet of commercial. What issues do you want the Planning Commission to tackle?
Well, I think that they've had work sessions as well on this project, and I think the question that needs to be answered before moving forward is whether or not this satisfies the compelling countervailing public interest as identified in the general plan. The applicant has gone through a number of iterations with the plan, and so this latest proposal, like you said, has the 79 residential units. 32 of them are affordable, so that's about 40% of them. And so that's really the question for the Planning Commission at this point. They have been intrigued by this proposal as well. And so if we can get some direction with the general plan question, then I think we can move forward either with the conditional use permit or not.
Okay. And again, this we could put in this so-called waterfall provision with this property as well.
Yeah, and that's something that we've talked about, and the applicant wants to talk to the Planning Commission about that.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Thanks, you, Jennifer.
All right. Okay, thank you.
It's Planner Jennifer Strader. Again, the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission meeting in regular session starting at 4:30. First item on the agenda is the Woodward Gargoza project. They meet, of course, at the Sheldon Richens Auditorium there at the Kimball Junction Library. KPCW News Time, 8:25. Well, the Park City Board of Education meeting tomorrow in a work session starting at 9 o'clock at the school district office in the studio with a rundown of the short agenda. Superintendent Amber Conley, good morning.
Good morning.
First, just wanted to recognize that you had received the Park City Police Department's Chief Award for your efforts to install security programs in our schools and to address the mental health issues throughout the district. That certainly didn't come with a lot of pushback, though. I mean, do you feel like this award justifies the board's actions over the last year?
You know, I was extremely honored and humbled to receive that award. And as Chief Carpenter expressed, that we've spent a lot of sleepless nights and late nights together over a variety of issues. And so that was really what the award was around. And it's even more it's so good to see how the entire community is starting to wrap around the need for our children to be aware of the mental well-being of our students.
Well, congratulations on the award there.
Thank you.
And also the news that Park City High School being named as the top high school in the state by USA Today. That's got to be good
news. Yep, first time by USA Today that our high school has been named that. We also received a phone call from another well-known reporting agency. I can't quite share which one, but we are back on another list for the top 500 for the amount of rigor and challenge that we have at our high school. But I have to say, you know, this isn't just a high school recognition. This is a recognition of an amazing pre-K through 12 system of educators and community that's willing to come to the table and be partners in education.
All right. Well, give us an update then on the elementary school entryways in terms of the security that we've been doing, putting in place.
Right. We've done a lot of safety measures. One is, you know, most importantly, the training both of our staff and our students. And certainly we need to do more, especially with the transition periods between Treasure Mountain and the high school. We have over 500 students that has one or more classes at the high school throughout the week. And so we've got to be able to have safe places for them and train them on, you know, if something were to happen during one of those passing periods, where do you go? What do? How do you get a hold of somebody? So that's something that we're really dedicated in our next big challenge. As far as our front offices, while we had anticipated to have these completely finished before the end of the winter holiday, which would have been January 2nd, we are at we are at the discretion of our contractors, and the countertops haven't arrived, and so we're waiting for our countertops to come in. And once those come in, then we'll be able to get the front offices finished in the elementaries. At that point, then we're starting our secondary schools, which I really do anticipate, because of the complexity of our secondary schools, entryways, front office areas, that we'll have those finished over the summer.
So there were some concerns that the schools may be lacking the staffing to handle the new entry systems. Is that been sorted out?
Right. I would disagree with that a little bit. I think one of the right now, because of the construction and the way that students and parents are having to enter the building and go through the office, is definitely a burden upon our front office staff. But actually looking at our visitor management system, our volunteer management system that we're looking at to begin this next year, I think it'll actually really help.
So you expect then the rest of the schools after the elementaries to be finished then sometime this summer?
I do.
Okay. Let's see, what's happening with the fencing then around the elementary schools? Has that been complete?
Right. So what we are working with is the PTOs and the Homeowners Association in three of the schools, which is McPollin, Parley's, and Trailside. And it's my understanding that McPollin has decided upon the type of fencing. And right now, though, as you know, we are in the winter season and the ground is frozen. And so we're going to have to wait until spring to get those put up.
Yeah. So do the homeowners associations have to ante up if it's more expensive than the...
Well, that is one of the conditions that we said, you know, here's what we're willing to do. But if there's really something that goes better with our aesthetic value of the open space, then we'll definitely work with them.
Right, because the rest of us really don't care what the fence looked like if we don't live there, right?
You know, and right, and you know, I would say that Jeremy Ranch has already put their fence up and has been that way for over 2 years, and certainly I never received one single phone call from when they were putting the fence in, nor afterwards. In fact, it's been the exact opposite of thank you for keeping our kids safe.
There was a safety lockdown drill done in December. So how did that go? And was that to test the Treasure Mountain Park City High School?
Right. So actually what that one was particularly is to help work on our communication. And what we did is we worked with Atlas RTX, who is a local company. But I anticipate in the next year that they're going to be a nationwide company for what they've been able to provide us. And so we were able to get all of the communication out to over 10,000 phone numbers in less than 20 minutes. So basically, we're in a lockdown. It's a lockdown drill. Stay tuned. And so we tested that. And then when we lifted that it wasn't a lockdown. It was actually a lockout drill. Then we were able to get that communication back out. So that was one of the main things. Also to continue the seriousness of these drills. And it's, you know, we practice how we play. And when the more you practice and the seriousness, that's, you know, if and when things happen, that's what we wanted to push. Now, we have our next one scheduled for February 1st, district-wide. And so what we're going to be looking at there, we are going to be holding it during a transition period of when the high school in Treasure Mountain is going to be transitioning in one of those bells.
All right. And you also learned some important lessons, I think, with the messaging in terms of how fast the messaging could go up, just depending on how the message was written.
Right. In fact, there is we found that on the first round that we put a hyphen in and it slowed it down tremendously. And so just that one little symbol. So now we aren't going to be putting any hyphen symbols in, just straight text.
Yeah. Periods are okay.
Evidently.
Okay. let's see. Just two items on the agenda, master planning and the upcoming budget. The master planning document, substantial. You've outlined the last 5 years of every initiative and program adopted by the previous school boards, along with the learning plans and programs, facilities, demographics, and community outreach. It's extensive and it's detailed. So who put this together?
Well, I would say, first of all, Nick Salmon, who's with the master planning process that was a consultant that the board approved. He was able to then gather all of the information, and we've had all the information within our office. A lot of it's been on our website. It's been out in the public. And I really appreciated his report, that it confirms, first of all, that we've done our homework. So when we start the actual master planning process, a lot of the work that we had done, 5 years prior, we didn't have the information. And so now we do. We have the analysis of each building. We have the transportation. We've been working very closely with our community partners, with both the county and the city. And so when we come to the table to be able to say, now what's next to address our facility issues, that information is going to be there.
So what happens now?
Right. So actually, that's why it's on the agenda. So the board's going to be able to have a discussion of now what. Are we ready to do a request for product for a master planner to help us begin that process? And so that's the discussion that we're going to have collaboratively.
So it sounds like the final data we're waiting to receive are the GIS mapping and the growth projections. So this presumably tells us what's needed for future facilities. If those projections come in showing little or no growth in our student population, do we back off that $100 million bond?
Right. So one of the things that our business administrator, Todd Haber, has done is that we had already went out to have the demographics done for this year. So we're, again, one step ahead. And again, very thankful for the confirmation that Nick Salmon has provided to us. So with that, I would say that we still are in a discussion area around facilities, right? We have modulars. And as we look at the second agenda item, which is around the fiscal year 19 budget, as we look at our programs, for instance, the data that we're receiving around our all-day four-year-old preschool program is tremendous. And so looking at the learning that we have for our preschool program, and we want to be able to expand that program, but yet we're unable to in the rest of our elementary schools because we don't have any space. And the boards prior had been very dedicated to small class sizes. And when you have small class sizes, you need more classroom space. And so regardless of, maybe if enrollment is flat over the next 3 years, we still have programmatic facility demands that aren't being met. And that's really where the board is having, first of all, to communicate to the public. We're continuing to have modulars, and there is a large portion of especially parents that have students that are in those modulars concerned about the safety of them. And I think that's another complexity to having those. But right now, looking at some of the budget items, I would say that there's going to have to be a decision around, do we have more modulars or do we just start cutting some programs?
Yeah. So you've gone through each of the schools and done kind of site evaluations to identify each of these needs, and you do have that list?
We do.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. How many mobile modular classrooms do we have for students? I know we've got one at the district office for your community ed department.
Yes, we do. So we have one at Treasure Mountain that holds two classrooms. We have one at McPolin. Parley's, we've been really lucky there. And so that's where we have the modulars.
Okay. So when you talk about...
Oh, excuse me. We have one at Trailside. Totally forgot about Trailside, so my apologies.
So when we talk about learning programs, I mean, are they equally available in all of the elementary schools, or are we seeing limitations because we don't have the facilities to offer them?
Right. So one of the things that we, of course, you have to look at the uniqueness of each elementary. So, for instance, we have two Title I schools, both Parley's and McPolin. Parley's is a Title I special program, which means that they don't have as many students on Title I. And anyone that's not familiar with Title I, it is based upon the number of students that qualify for free and reduced lunch. You look at McPolin, and we have a significant amount of students that qualify for free and reduced lunch, but also which makes it a school-wide Title I school. So when you look at the actual programs that are needed that are different, there are differences. So that is why we piloted the all-day four-year-old program at McPolin. And again, I cannot express, you look at our data of the results that we're getting from our students, and it really is making a tremendous difference. So in our mind, if it's working for them, it's going to work for all kids even better. And so that is one of the things that we wanted to look at, being able to expand to all of our elementary schools.
So if we, in fact, do go ahead and build new facilities, do these modulars, can they be used besides for other things besides classrooms?
Absolutely. They can be reused, or we can they have a great resale value, too. So that's, you know, it is a decent investment, so you're not throwing money away. The one thing you asked about the programs, you know, we do have different types of programs at our elementary schools. For instance, Parley's Park is the only school that has a dance specialist that incorporates the mini curriculum items within dance. And that was part of a Beverly Taylor Sorensen state grant. And so that was, but the reason that we qualified for that was because it's a Title I school.
Okay. When does a committee get formed to take the master planning to completion?
Yep, that's part of the agenda item for the board to decide.
And we're going to have Todd Halber in next week because you got a special meeting. But real quick, in terms of the timeline to complete budget talks, we know that it was accelerated with the hopes of giving administrators more time to recruit and secure new hires. So are we, and after coming off of a year when we had hired nearly 40 new staff and put in salary increases across the board, are we looking for a lot of new staff?
You know, this is a discussion, thank you for asking, around what we are going to be talking about tomorrow. And one of the things that my team is continuing to stress is that oftentimes staff helps, right? It helps solve problems. But the other thing that where we are is being able to provide structure and capacity within our current staff. And so we're looking at bigger issues around how do we provide more time for our staff to plan, prepare, collaborate. And those aren't necessarily, you know, those aren't adding teachers. That's adding maybe days to the contract or hours onto their contract afterwards. We're also looking at how do we really focus on the board's values around recruitment and retention. And retention, you look at the nationwide results and, you know, teachers get into education, then they're leaving 3 to 5 years. So what can we do as an organization to ensure that we're providing the mentoring, the support for our new teachers so they don't leave our community, but leave education completely? And so retention is, you can't necessarily throw a staff member at retention. Those are systems and processes for support.
So do you have some kind of ratio then? Because, I mean, as you came on, you had heard the complaints that administration was too top heavy. Is there some kind of ratio, though, when you talk about administrators versus staff?
Right. So in Utah, it's an interesting ratio. And we are definitely within the average to low area national. Right. And I think it's important for the listeners to understand that the more programs you have, the more managers of programs that you need to be able to have successful programs. And that's one of the things that we found is 2 years ago when the previous board asked us to cut administration significantly, we were very, you know, very straightforward in saying programs are going to suffer. And so I think some of the criticism then, of course, me being the leader of administration, has had is that programs have suffered. And so now that the current board had said, we're ready to support you financially, what do you need? It has taken us a while to get those programs back into an area that's efficient and to recover from what we were cut from.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
You know, I have a couple of things. First of all, we have a suicide prevention lunch and learn on January 17th, and that's QPR, Question, Persuade, Refer. And that is the protocol that we use for our staff and our students, so inviting those. Also, the board has an informal board meeting, which is two of our board members are just basically available to hear concerns, questions, have a conversation with the community, and that is Wednesday at McPolin, 6 to 8 p.m. And finally, we have our author in residence. So we have our one book, one author, 10th through 12th grade. And she is here doing a review of her literature, which is Salt to Sea, which is I'm just now finishing. It's a great book.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. Okay, Amber, thanks. Well, just 4 weeks away from the Winter Olympic Games, joining me now in the studio with an update, Tom Kelly with the U.S. Skiing and Snowboarding. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. 31 days to go. It's getting close.
All right. Well, let's start with the Tour de Ski. This is the 7-event, 3-country race.
Yeah.
Cross-country race.
Yeah, it was supposed to be a 7-stage tour this year, but we lost one to a microburst Wednesday in Oberstdorf. Pretty amazing deal. During women's qualifying, it started lightning and a microburst took down a couple of big trees. So they wisely canceled the rest of the competition that day. So we lost that. But in the end, it was really good again for the U.S. ski team. Jessie Diggins finishing third overall, and she had to earn it on the Alpe Surmise, the big hill climb on Sunday. She was 10 seconds behind Finland's Krista Parmakoski and sitting in fourth place, and she went out and attacked Parmakoski on the hill and broke away for a big boost, finishing third of the two Norwegians ahead of her. Top 10 finish for Sadie Bjornsson, two Americans in the top 10. That's never happened before. Rosie Brennan from Park City getting a finish, 24th, career best for her in Tour de Ski. And Liz Steven, who lives and trains here, finishing 16th. She was fifth on the hill climb, which is actually a little bit off the pace for her. Jessie Diggins, third fastest up the hill climb. And this is basically like going from the base of Park City Mountain up to the top on cross-country skis, and they do it in, I think that whole stage, 9 kilometers, is about 25, 30 minutes is all. It's just amazing.
Like to the top of Bonanza or to like the mid-mountain area?
Probably mid-mountain area. Yeah. I mean, it's a climb, and it's grueling, and a few switchbacks, but a lot of it's just climbing the wall. So it's pretty interesting event, but really successful for the USA. Those girls are going to take a little break right now. We also named 7 more cross-country skiers to the team, so that team is forming up nicely. Rosie Brennan sealing a spot on the Olympic team, and she'll be one of the athletes vying for one of those relay spots in what we hope will be a real go at the medals this year for that team. One more week in Olympic qualifying, sprints up in Dresden. I don't see that changing the Olympic selection so much. We also have athletes up at the LLB and U.S. Cross Country Championships, and we'll be selecting some athletes from those points and those of the Cross Country Super Tour. All those Olympic announcements coming up the 22nd of January of that week.
Okay, so gosh, the results we're seeing from the women. Anything from men?
Men's side, really not as strong. We had only one man finish the tour, Paddy Caldwell. Erik Bjornsson is having a really, really good season. He did withdraw before the end of the tour, but he's been scoring in pretty much every event this year. So a big, big step up for him on the World Cup Tour. He's the only skier we have on the men's side in the top 50 on the distance rankings. We have a few more, Andy Newell, Simi Hamilton on the sprint side. So particularly Simi Hamilton will be a factor at the Olympics for us. Erik Bjornsson, I think a little bit early to kind of look at him for the medals, but really happy with the progress we've seen with him this year.
Michaela Schifrin, she can't be stopped or caught. Bodie Miller, of course, coming out and saying she's the best he's ever seen.
The Bodie interview on Michaela was fantastic. And folks, if you haven't seen that, just Google Bodie Miller, Michaela Schifrin, and look at this story. It was really quite something. It was a Reuters news story from this week. But right now, she is unstoppable. She's won 8 of the last 9 races she's been in this year. She's been on the podium in every single technical event. It is really quite remarkable. But I do hearken back to a year ago when she had this big win streak going in slalom, and it got to the point that it was a little bit nerve-wracking with the media keeping track of every single win that she had and leading up to this. And finally, she went into Zagreb a year ago and lost a race, and highly unusual at the time, but it just broke the tension. So, you know, right now she's got one more big race coming up in Flachau, Austria tomorrow night, Tuesday night, under the lights, and that'll be a good one. You can follow that one on NBCSN and Olympic Channel. But she'll probably do well there and then take a little bit of a break as the tour heads more towards speed events. Now, here's an interesting scenario right now. Lindsey Vonn does have the top Super G results. So right now, as we stand, she's on the Olympic team. But in the downhill, there's 4 other girls who have achieved the top objective criteria, either a top 3, a top 5, or a top 10. And Lindsey needs to get one of those. So I think this weekend at Bad Kleinkirchheim and then coming up in Cortina, she's going to be gunning for the podium in a downhill, and I'm sure she's going to get it. She's had a nice little break right now, but it is kind of interesting to see the depth on that women's speed team. But at the end of the day, it's Lindsey Vonn who probably has the best shot at a gold medal, but she's got to go and claim that spot.
Okay, big events happening this week at Deer Valley.
Yeah, Olympic selection is just pervasive in everything that we do right now, and that's going to be the case here in Deer Valley. Wednesday and Thursday, a little bit earlier than normal, folks. So if you're kind of into this cycle of, hey, it's Thursday, let's get out to Deer Valley for moguls, it actually is Wednesday and Thursday night at 7 o'clock for moguls. And on Friday, it's the high-flying aerials at 8 o'clock. Things to watch, Troy Murphy of Park City. He's got one mogul's top three. He needs another one to make that Olympic team. Jalen Kauf has done that already. Those spots in moguls are going to be hotly contested. On the aerial side, one athlete achieving the top criteria for the Olympics right now, and that's Kylie McKinnon. She won an event in Moscow in front of the big city crowd this Saturday, a first win of her career. She had a top three at Deer Valley a year ago, and that gets her pretty much on the Olympic team. Ashley Caldwell has one top three so far, so she's going to be gunning for this at Deer Valley. Three moguls events and three aerials events left before the close of Olympic selection. But you're going to see probably two or three Olympic spots determined this week right at Deer Valley.
Okay. We've got, with Olympic selection, I had heard that, of course, Ted Ligety making it and Megan McJames.
Yeah, it's on the Alpine side, of course, Michaela Schifrin is a lock right now. But with the final GS events for both men and women, Ted Ligety now with a top five finish has qualified for the team. And Megan McJames qualifying behind Michaela Schifrin on basis of her World Cup standings right now. She's the second best skier in the World Cup rankings. So congratulations to Park City's Megan McJames going to her third Olympics.
Yeah, so I mean, if Megan and Michaela are the only ones scoring, you know, Olympic qualifying points, why isn't Megan on the team?
Well, the criteria is really different for those two. And, you know, we have a number of skiers in that situation, but we'll also round that team out. There'll be other skiers named to that Olympic team as well. But the criteria for making the national team, the standing team year in and year out, is different than the criteria for making the Olympic team.
Okay, so everything has to be chosen by when?
The Olympic team will be announced, the nominations will be announced the week of January 22nd. And we don't know the definitive date because one of the challenges we have is the actual quota, the number of athletes we can name, that's going to be dynamic and it could change a little bit that week. So on that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of that week of the 22nd, we'll be making all of the full team announcements.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, just see everybody out at Deer Valley Wednesday, Thursday night at 7 and Friday at 8.
Okay, Tom, thanks.
See you, Leslie.
It's Tom Kelly with you at Skiing and Snowboarding. KPCW News Time now, 8:53. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW, where the Park City Education Foundation just awarded its teachers grants right before the holiday break. In the studio with details, I have the foundation's director, Abby McNulty, along with one of the parents and one of the volunteers on the teacher grant committee, Jody Fay. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So we'll start with you, Abby, and just maybe a quick background of the Teachers Grants program.
Yep. So the Teacher Grant program was one of the first initiatives of the Education Foundation over 30 years ago. And we typically grant for innovative or creative ideas that teachers ask they ask for funding to help solve problems in their classroom. This year we funded 26 programs, and it's over $80,000 of support. And the program is supported by the Fay Family Foundation, the Deer Valley Resort, and PCF's Parent Appeal donors.
Right. So 30 years ago, do you have that number in terms of how much we raised?
30 years ago, it was one grant for $2,000.
Come a long way.
Yeah.
Well, as Abby mentioned, Jody, the Fay Family Foundation making a generous gift of some $20,000 for teacher grants. How come?
Well, my parents have a foundation in town, and they do support a lot of different nonprofits. And I started on the Ed Foundation 3 years ago and served on the Teacher Grant Committee. After my first meeting, I called my parents and said, "You have no idea how incredible these teachers are in town and how little money we have to fund. Is there any way you'd be willing to help?" And they said, "Okay."
Okay. So that makes up a big chunk, a quarter of it. Yeah.
It sure does. Yeah. And what it's helped us do is really stretch beyond what we've been able to do in the past to not only to fund additional grants, but in the past we've also had to divide the money and give grants partial funding and say to teachers, you know, we can only afford, you know, 50% of your grant. Hopefully you can find some other funds. And so this has allowed us to really fully fund so many grants. And it's really amazing how we see those grants in action.
Yeah. So when you talk about 80 programs, that's 26 programs.
Mm-hmm.
That's several in each school then, huh?
Mm-hmm. It sure is. And every school applies for different things. And we have a committee of parents and community members representing retired teachers and parents from different schools and parents whose kids have long left the district. And so it's always a robust conversation about what to fund. And I think we come out with some of, you know, these really exciting, wonderful programs. And the idea is to test them, see how they do in the classroom setting, and whether there's an opportunity to fund more broadly at the school.
Yeah. So, Jody, which grants were you pretty excited about this year? Anything in particular?
This year, I like the continuation of the Makerspace. So it started, to me, years ago with Susan Beesom at Trailside, phenomenal librarian media specialist, just asking for 3D pens and Brainiac toys. And then Ecker, last year, we funded a Makerspace at Ecker, which now Dave Gomez from Parley's went and started one at Parley's based off of Ecker's. And then this year, McPullen asked for one, too, and so we're starting one at McPullen.
So what is that?
It's a great question, and Jody, jump in. So maker spaces are tools and materials for kids to learn to tinker. They use their hands to build things. They're, at Ecker Hill, they're testing concepts in physics and, you know, floating boats in water that they've handmade and making little roller coasters. At the high school, they're using laser cutters and 3D printers. Mm-hmm. At the elementary school, Jody was just telling me this morning about paper bags and buttons and, you know, tubes and it's creation.
Mm-hmm. And it's done within the classroom.
They actually, Ecker has a dedicated room. So does Parley's, and Trailside and McPullen will do it in their libraries.
Okay. So the teachers were notified of the funding right before break, so the programs can get underway?
Yes.
This school year?
Absolutely. The goal is to have them up and running the second half of the school year. So teachers are now ordering all their supplies and getting everything in place.
All right. And then anything you are especially excited about, Abby?
Like Jody,
it's
I
hard
love.
To pick, I know.
Yeah, it is hard to pick, and I am dyslexic, so anything I get to do with my hands is exciting. So I love the idea of maker spaces too, and I love that it's working in other schools, and so teachers and principals are adopting it in their own school. I also love we funded take home reading books for preschool. I think that's also incredibly important. Just early literacy and having reading-rich environments at home is so great. There's also a virtual reality grant that we gave to Jeremy Ranch for K through 5, and it's a highly engaging experience that allows students to travel virtually to places they may not ever physically be able to visit. So, I mean, lots of really cool things.
And grants don't have to be large. I mean, we do fund large grants, but small grants just go a long way. The Watchdogs program was started at Ecker last year with Sam Salinas to bring dads into the schools, and that was just $500, yep. I believe. This year, Osmo went into, Parley's Park, mm-hmm. and it's a $800 grant for programs on iPads. And then Jeremy Ranch got so excited, their tech teachers already ordered it, their coding teacher, and McPullen's looking into it all as well. So it's just a little bit sometimes goes a long way.
Mm-hmm. Right, and again, this is all done privately, so that it's not done through property taxes.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. These are additional funds that are raised in the community and given into our schools.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention about it? I just have another minute.
Real quick, Running with Ed registration opens today. The race is May 19th. And also we have our One Book, One Community Read. Our author, Ruta Sepetis, is in town today visiting Park City High School and tomorrow as well. And we'll do a community event tomorrow night, 7 o'clock at Jim Santee Auditorium.
Okay. Abby, Jody, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thanks, Leslie.